Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is December 20th, 2018. We are wrapping up 2018 on our way to 2020. We will see you in a year. This is the final episode. This is the final episode between then and now, unless we decide to release some in 2019, I guess. It is episode 603, and I know that might sound like the mark of the beast to some of you, but we don't have any guests this week because I'm not the same person who will make a mistake three times. I'll make it twice.
Yeah.
I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
You got to give it a few more years apart.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's
103,
cyclical,
603, 803. I mean, that's kind of maybe where we're going to end up, and it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
I guess at that point, I'll just have to accept it grimly.
If you see I've brought guests on for an episode that ends in 03, you can just check out that week. Go like, oh. Yeah,
that's true. I'm the only, apart from you, who's more culpable. I'm the only veteran of both.
I do like that you immediately made it clear who's more culpable. But
no, I'm not shirking my share of the blame.
I mean, 103 has the unfortunate in that there's a 104 to go with it. Which we both also lived through, so the corrections. And as somebody who listened to the whole show recently pointed out, 105 continues some of the corrections, so that's good. That's great. That episode had
basically
a creeping...
Johnny just turns into the sort of ghost caretaker from The Shining, saying, "I corrected them, sir." "And when they tried to stop me from doing my duty, I corrected them too." Yep, that's Johnny. It's pretty much exactly like him.
Yeah, that's the authentic experience. I just like to refer to it as a miasma from 103 that just seeps along and occasionally pops back up. Completely unrelated to that, I'm also joined today by Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hey, I'm still here.
Had you actually said anything yet?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well then it wasn't still here. Yeah, this is episode 603, and John is not with us. He was abducted by aliens. You can't prove me wrong. Actually, he didn't tell us where he was going. He just said he wasn't going to be here, so he's not here. So you have heard the last of John Lindemann for the year 2018, because next week we will be taking off.
So just to be clear, the null hypothesis is he was abducted by aliens.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with that. Also, it doesn't really matter if we were taking off next week or not, because that episode would have come out in 2019 anyway. So I guess that conditional is a moot point. I just wanted to make it clear that we will not be here. But we wanted to get at least one episode out before the holidays so you have something to listen to instead of engaging with your families, which is a time-honored tradition of the holidays. So we went ahead and said, we're going to do a short episode focused on your email, which is why you may have seen the RFN Twitter account call for email this week, and also why you may have seen it continue to push for Punch-Out Warriors. We're not going to stop. We're never going to stop. It's like the world's worst advent calendar. Every day, a new awful tweet. So, you're welcome. But Guillaume wanted to give a quick update on a game he's been playing, so...
Oh, did I? Oh, yeah.
You did? Yes.
I've been playing a ton of Overcooked, of course, and I've been going through the four-star stuff. Two, yes. And recently, Team 17, is that their name? Updated the game and sent a free DLC, 5 levels that are seasonally appropriate. So there's like 2 new chefs, an elf and a snowman, and you can make hot chocolate, and I can't remember what the other thing is, but it makes sense for a winter level.
Booze.
But yeah, and they're pretty challenging. So if you're just getting the game now, maybe start with the levels that ramp up in the main game before trying the seasonal stuff. But I don't have a whole lot of kind of Christmas themed games, so it's kind of nice to get this. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Other than that, I've been playing Katamari Damacy, which despite my complaints last week, is just an amazing game.
Funnily enough, it's another relatively rare case of UK pricing being favourable. That is £16, which compares nicely with the $30 that you mentioned last week, especially, if we don't really know what the sterling is going to be worth from one day to the next at the minute. It's always nice when the domestic pricing is as good as that.
Well, I mean, you and I can both commiserate in that in a couple of days, neither of us will have a fully functioning government. So Guillaume gets to lord that over us.
Yes, there's Canada's king of the Anglosphere in terms of competency right now, I think.
I don't know. We got to check with New Zealand and see what they're up to. I always just assume the worst.
As you should.
Being isolated out there, it's God knows what happens. What happens in Auckland stays in Auckland, although that's not their capital. So I'm aware.
Anyway, that's pretty much it for me.
If it is their capital, I'm going to be really upset. All right, anyway, email. So you can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I'm saying it twice because somebody asked me in the Discord yesterday what the email was, and I was like, are you serious? For real?
Did you say rfn@nintendoworldreport.com?
I did say rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
Huh, okay.
Those are three letters. It's not like you don't have to spell it out. It's not A-R-R-E-F-F.
Holy shit. I-N. R-F-N. Radio Free Nintendo. I get it.
That's what it stands for?
I think it is.
Oh my God. I was legitimately like, yeah, it's RFN at the website. Okay. I was like, okay, maybe I just need to say it more. Maybe I need to say it more. So I'm going to say it every email. I'm not going to do that. Guillaume.
Yes.
Would you be so kind as to read the first email?
Sure.
No plan went into this, so I don't know who I've assigned what.
Okay,
there's no traps.
Here it starts. Hello, my name is Natsam. And I would like to send you, yes. And I would like to send you an email. DLC is a big conversation now with Smash Out. I want to ask you about the single-player game DLC that Nintendo has released for Switch. Both Xenoblade 2, Electra Boohoo, and Zelda The Wine Thornberries had season passes only, and had large quote-unquote story content released at the end. A Battle Master mode was included in the middle, and the rest was content that is best enjoyed in the middle of a playthrough. I got both packs after I had completed the respective games and some armor in Zelda that couldn't be upgraded from its meager base stats. Or a mission to make getting rare blades easier when I had already gotten them all. And that did not make me appreciate the extra content when I had conquered the land of Hyrule or Alrest already. The additions I see as best enjoyed in Master Mode / New Game Plus. But that is a big ask to replay a 100-hour plus game, never mind for multiple games. Why has Nintendo chosen this way of supporting titles, and how do you think it compares to the way they support multiplayer titles? Like the Octo expansion in Splatoon 2, or the free editions in Mario Kart 8, Mario Tennis Aces, and ARMS. Is there another way to include these side quests to quote-unquote make the game smoother, without expecting you to play after all they're all out? Is this gulf in DLC styles between single-player and multiplayer that clear from other developers? I remind you, my name is Natsam.
Which so is noted. Weird,
because there's nothing that indicates in like the name, like the email address or anything, that the name could be Sam. So
it's important to note, though, that it's not, I remind you, my name is not Sam. So, technically speaking, we've not been reminded of anything. That's a proper noun. Hmm. That'd be a quote of saying, I remind you, Paris. And I'm like, what about it? And you're like, no, that's the end of the sentence. And I'm like, you mean the city or the mythological character? You're like, no, the sentence ended. Shut the fuck up. And it's like, okay, so noted.
I guess one thing I want to say about the single player, why would they do this for multiple single player 100-hour plus games, and they're two different teams, and so probably they don't really care that much, or that maybe there might not have been like communication between the two. But certainly, like when a developer creates a DLC, like they don't necessarily take into account what other games, other people, other developers, other publishers might be doing out there. They just want you to go ahead and keep playing their game or return to their game and not sell it back to GameStop. So I don't think that, you know, like this kind of like a strategy from Nintendo or a concerted effort to, you know, do DLC in a stupid way in long games from Nintendo. I think it's just like, I don't know, maybe it just made more sense to them that way. Like the, sorry, I haven't played either of the games or either of the DLCs, but like,
yeah, I've played both the games, but neither of the DLCs. Yeah,
I've played both the games and both the DLCs. So we've got all the spectrum available to us.
Okay.
There we go. We so need somebody who's played none of the games and but all of the DLC.
John's got that coming, don't worry.
Again, he's not here to confirm or deny that, so but he's been abducted by aliens and only played Torna.
I'll definitely agree that it does not seem all that interesting to put.
Yeah,
like,
it's, I think that's some of the reason why I haven't bought the DLC, because I enjoyed both games and poured enormous amounts of time into them. Yes. And of course, there is, you know, entirely kind of original stuff there, especially Torna, you know, which, you know, it should be stated they've also kind of sold as a standalone physical release. So there is a difference there. The email points out the similarities, which are significant as far as I could tell. You know, so you do wonder if there's, you know, a certain level of coordination went into that. You know, that because they are so similar, but they are not entirely similar either, you know, because like I said, with the standalone element. And I mean, the issue of the Octo expansion is interesting, because that is a single player expansion in a principally multiplayer game.
Right. It's almost a weird like counter to the email, because ultimately,
because that expansion is basically just a one player expansion. I mean, oh, yeah, you can unlock like cosmetics and stuff for the multiplayer, but you know, essentially, it's just kind of more content for the single player Splatoon 2. Which I mean, I did play that. I pretty much did everything in it, enjoyed it up to a point. Obviously, you know, kind of like what we said about Smash recently. Like, it's no, by no means the main event. And then Octo Expansion kind of comes along and gave you kind of more of that, but somewhat different, kind of broke it into smaller chunks and gave you a new kind of overworld and some new characters to, or underworld as it actually is literally. You know, so it was a cool sort of thing for Splatoon 2, because you're talking about a game, you know, like with the free updates that are mentioned in the email again, that there's a model that does seem very coordinated, really, you know, because you are talking about a lot of the same kind of, not if not literally the same developers, you know, on a personal level, you know, the sort of integration that they've achieved at EPD these days inside Nintendo. You would have thought, you know, stuff like Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, Splatoon 2, ARMS, you know, the similarities in the models of providing free updates, that, you know, is not a coincidence. That stuff that they've, you know, kind of, you know, reached a sort of an approach that they think is effective for trying to keep people engaged with the game. Mario Tennis as well would fall into this category. But Splatoon 2, with the actual big, you know, when they finally charged you for something, it was for single player content, which was interesting. But I felt that I played it, I thought it was worth it. And I guess it's kind of telling that I paid for that and not for the other games, even though Splatoon 2 is also a game I've poured a hell of a lot of time into, but I hadn't poured hundreds of hours into singles player Splatoon 2, because it's not that kind of, you know, it's fairly short, the single player component. And, you know, the idea of kind of more of that, but, you know, with new twists and stuff, was probably more appealing to me than more of something that I have played for an ungodly amount of time already.
I kind of wonder if it's kind of a side effect of Nintendo's way of developing games and just being like very secretive about it, and kind of keeping things as internal as possible. And just because sometimes you've got some developers will, you know, do betas or whatever, will seek outside opinion, and it seems like Nintendo doesn't necessarily do that as much, and so they get their feedback after the game is released, and it's as if both the Zelda and Xenoblade 2 teams got feedback about sticking the points that were sticking out, or sticking points. Anyway, I was right the first time. Just, you know, like from the players only, like after the game had been released. And also, like, both these games are huge. Both these games were under like a certain pressure to be released, like to be completed fast for the first year of the Switch.
Yeah.
So there might have been a combination of that going on. Just like, well, like we don't have time to implement all the things that we want to implement. We got to finish this. We've got a certain tight deadline. And also, like, we're maybe, you know, not getting outside opinion as much.
I mean, Torna has substantial sort of technological differences from Xenoblade 2 in terms of the engine and things, you know, like they'd made significant progress, I guess, with how they kind of work.
Right, but there's also a lot of
Switch at that point, so that shows you that you know, they had kind of moved on substantially from that, from the full game, you know, the Xenoblade 2, and perhaps, you know, how that was, you know, a bit time pressured. You know, just 9 months into the system's life or whatever it was.
Right. And there's also significant, like, quality of life improvements that just show up in the expansion. It's like, well, they heard what players were complaining about in the game and then went ahead and implemented changes in the DLC.
So, the two things I want to get to before I start diving into the specifics of those games is that, one, both of the Zelda and Xenoblade 2 DLC packages are structurally almost identical. And what I mean by that is they announced the DLC package and you got some stuff right out of the gate for buying it.
So you're trying to get early adopters to also get the DLC early to put the money down straight away.
Xenoblade 2's case, it was just a bunch of shit. It was like, here's a bunch of cores, here's a bunch of rare cores, here's a bunch of just stuff. I think it may have added a couple quests, but like, and then they just kept adding blades as they went. Like, they just continually put new blades out there. Zelda had free DLC, which wasn't part of the package they kept putting out there. And so an example of that is, in fact, ironically enough, Rex's diver suit. And then they had the DLC pack, and you got the DLC pack 1, which was all they were ready to talk about when they first talked about it. And that is the Trial of the Sword. And there was some other stuff sprinkled in there too, just some kind of odds and ends. And then both of them, close to a year after initial release, dropped their big DLC. So the Zelda DLC came out about a year ago now, I would guess. It's been a little bit. Or close to it. And Xenoblades came out, you know, about 10-ish months, 9-ish months after the game. It's probably about the same for both of them. So, like, there was like a weird second burst of the big package coming later. What I will say is that of the two, Zelda is very much, you know, we're going to build this. We're really just going to occupy the space.
Yeah, populate the existing world with new things to do.
Right. And I would actually be curious, like, if I went back to that area because the Trial of the Sword, most of it takes... The Trial of the Sword almost entirely takes place outside of world. It takes place in a basically a zone, like one of the shrines. The big DLC, the one that gets you the stupid motorcycle, most of that takes place or is littered around the main world.
Was it Ballad of the Champions, is it?
Yeah. Like, and so you have to go back and fight some bosses again, and you have to wander around. And then there's a dungeon, and there's some stuff. But there's some stuff they added in the in-game world. I'd be curious if you go there, if they structurally changed how those areas look, or if they had kind of planned, or if they just said, yeah, this spot will work, and just slapped it down there. But Xenoblade 2, obviously, is a fully functioning game.
Yeah, and it's a new area. That's right. the key difference. I suppose, even though I've not purchased either For some of the reasons already discussed, I think that's what always made it seem more attractive to Gourmet, yeah. is that it you would do, be a new places to see.
You do go to Gourmet for a minute, but that's really, it's like you are there for a very brief period of time and then you leave. And you get, you know, you get to see it for a couple minutes and then you're out. You can go back and do quests and stuff, but basically it's in the new zone. And so, to Guillaume's point, a lot of the things that they did that people didn't like about the first game are really more structural about them making the game smaller. So there's no rotating blades, which people hated the core system. Well, there's no cores because the blades are all fixed. It's a fixed party from start to end. Some of the combat stuff actually started getting patched in the main game. Like they kept patching the main game and a lot of that stuff carried over.
Yeah.
But I think the reason, I think Torna versus, well, no. So really, the big thing that unites Torna and the Champions Ballad is that both of them said, like, hey, we're going to offer you story that sets up what these games were. And in fact, they both do this, which is weird, but obviously deliberate, because they did it twice. And we know for a fact the Zelda team talks quite frequently with Monolith Soft.
I do, yeah, there certainly has been, you know, collaboration going with Skyward Sword, even, you know, going yeah. back quite a way now.
Yeah, so, like, obviously these people talk, and of course, Nintendo has their corporate orders about what needs to happen in the DLC space, because this is a Nintendo-driven initiative. We want to have more DLC in our titles. I think in a single-player game, really, your options are add more to game, and if you look at other single player, these big single player games, how they add DLC, they largely do the same thing. They add new quest lines. Maybe they add a new, like, story that ties into the main story loosely, you know, like a side story. Or they make a little bit of prequel content or sequel content, you know, what happened after the events. But a lot of times you kind of have to try to shim it in alongside what's currently going on, because it wouldn't necessarily make sense to append something to the end after the problem has been taken care of. And you've already had, you know, your story detente. So where do you, like, so the answer kind of prequel makes sense for both of these games from a story standpoint. And so I guess it kind of makes sense that that's how they're built. I actually was fine with more content. I'm less, I feel like the Zelda DLC kind of looks bad compared to Torna. Now, it also costs significantly less than Torna. I think it's $10 less. Because ultimately, like, for me, the highlight of Zelda, I didn't like the dungeon that came with it. I really didn't like the Champion's Ballad. But to me, the highlight is that the motorcycle that you unlock basically shatters the game engine, because it can't keep up rendering. Like, that's, to me, that was the highlight of that DLC. So that's not great. Whereas Torna, I actually really liked. I think it, on its own, it stands up as a game. And I almost would say all the little chintzy stuff they give you for buying the DLC is really just to, as Greg said, to get your money now. So they're giving you something.
Yeah, that is an approach to go to kind of how Nintendo coordinates these things or kind of harmonizes them. That is an approach they've done across multiplayer and single player games. You see that with the Mario Kart 8 DLC on Wii U. Where, you know, you were getting substantial track packs, but, you know, for giving your money in advance of that, it would be things like multicolored Yoshis or Shy Guys or whatever it were. You know, they've always given that little sweetener, whether it's multiplayer or single player, for people who, you know, are going to commit to buying it now and you have to capitalize on the early adopter crowd.
Well, there may be some financial reason for that as well, beyond just getting people in to buy it now. There's also this whole lawsuit going on right now in Germany that Nintendo is dealing with about their policies around pre-orders and digital pre-orders specifically.
Yes, basically, yeah, it's like pre-purchase, I guess, is how they word it, I think, on the store, with the little green symbols. And of course, it's something they do, you know, across regions, but the differences with the legal sort of consumer protections, you know, I guess they're kind of running afoul potentially of in the EU.
Right. So that's a non-issue if they've given you something. Like, legitimately, what are you going to do? You can't cancel the pre-order. You already got stuff. So there is a certain amount of, like, maybe there is something that Machiavellian in this strategy. But in general, it's really just to get people to say, like, hey, instead of just,
I suppose actually the one exception I could think, do they give you anything for purchasing the Smash Brothers DLC only?
Nothing. No, they did. No, they did. They gave you Rex's costume.
Oh, Rex. There you go.
So yeah,
it's a Mii costume, is it?
Yeah, you got something.
I was really struggling to remember what it would be because Piranha Plant was just for early purchases of the game in general. It's Rex's
Mii costume.
Yeah, so, that's. I mean, they've always been pretty weak, but
that one is particularly. It was the only piece of DLC that's ever come with an apology. It's like, yeah, oh,
I mean, it is an interesting thing, isn't it? Kind of speaks to the tension I'm sure that exists within plenty of organizations, but certainly Nintendo themselves, where it's got, on the one hand you have, hey, buy it now, get this now, you know, it's going to be awesome, buy it now, and then you get Sakurai saying, well, you know, hopefully the fighters will be things you actually want to have paid for, so you might want to wait to see what they actually are. You know, it's just completely kind of opposite, you know, the sort of creative and the commercial sides, but, you know, that's life for a major corporation.
At the same time, he knew that 20 days after he said that, they would be revealing the first character, so, you know, he may have been demurring a little bit, just kind of for like, just for show. Cause I bet their sales spiked as soon as Joker was announced as the DLC character. But in terms of putting DLC in a single player game, I just struggle to see what your other options are. I mean, short of creating new distinct content. I mean, these games sold a ton of copies. And so even Xenoblade 2 sold respectably, you know, it makes sense to put the DLC in them because you get, you know, get the opportunity to remonetize a customer who's already bought the game.
Well, no, with the games of this kind of scale, you get the feeling that it's something they're perhaps particularly eager to do because there's a limit, especially, you know, in the North American market on how much they're going to end up charging for a game like a Zelda, right. Even though it probably costs them far more to make than many of the games that also cost $60 that they would publish. And so Nintendo, I think, is much more kind of forthright and principled about kind of having DLC be stuff that they actually develop after the fact. And, you know, is substantial than a lot of companies. But there is still an element of like, hey, you know, this is something we poured a hell of a lot of time and effort into to, you know, get it to where it is. You know, this world and all the physics and everything, all the systems, how they work and all that. And, you know, in a way, we kind of think it's something we should have charged more for. But, you know, the market reality is you can't. So you kind of do it by the back door. With DLC that you know, capitalizes on that world, obviously populate it with a few more things to do, and then you're kind of, you know, charging somewhat in excess of that, of what it really took to create that content to redress the balance a little bit. Right. So, you know, I could, and it's a kind of a Zelda tradition, you know, I mean, they pour so much of themselves and time and effort into kind of making a game on that scale, that ambitious, that it has these kinds of spillovers. But obviously in the past that would turn into something like Majora's Mask,
right?
Whereas now, you know, they could go the DLC route for kind of recouping more of the sort of development costs, not all monetary either. Some of it I think is just sort of pride and time and effort,
right? I mean, it seems. And just things like, we've created lore for this world. We don't have to go create a whole new set of it. We just continue to expand what we've got. I mean, we don't talk about that in terms of game design, but like, that's a pretty significant time investment, especially for something like Torna, where they probably already in their mind knew what the story of Torna was before they decided to make it, because a lot of it is precursor for what happens in the main game. They also made it clear that there, at one point early on, they thought about having a section of the main game that was in the past and just said, no, that's too much. We can't do it.
Well, it's a compromise that you can make as well in terms of, okay, if we sort of partition this off and end up doing it as DLC, you know, it gives us the opportunity to like draw a line on how much exposition we want to actually do. And then like for people who are actually into that stuff, they can actually pay the money and play the DLC and actually get that experience. And which is something we can sort of give proper attention after the development of the regular game has concluded, that, you know, some people, I imagine, you know, I've probably seen and done enough in that world by the end of that game. So it's a nice compromise by balancing it that way.
I was just going to say that the DLC also lets these teams release stuff that sometimes Nintendo would traditionally maybe save for a sequel. And so, like, the whole... I'm thinking specifically of the bike in Zelda. Like, this is something that they had been thinking about, I think, probably earlier in the development of the game. But then perhaps like weren't sure they could implement it, you know, like quickly enough, or they couldn't find a way to fit it in the game's world. And so, you know, like it became an idea that was saved for the DLC. And like maybe we wouldn't have seen it in a sequel, but like this DLC gave them kind of an excuse to add that to the game. Greg mentioned something about, these games taking time to make and, you know, like it, so, but there's a limit to how much they can charge for them. But also, these games take a long time to complete. And it's it's a good idea for Nintendo to charge you for the DLC before you even started the game. You know, like sell you the DLC before you realize that, you know what, maybe 100 hours of content is enough.
I'm full. Yeah. that's enough. Yeah. No, as I said, it's kind of that early adopter kind of hype phase rather than, you know, what comes later. But I do think they do a good job of actually, you know, producing things that show that they've actually, you know, gone to a significant effort to make these things after the fact. And, yeah, you know, provide, you know, like substantially kind of novel content and stuff that people would be willing to pay for. But it certainly doesn't hurt to capitalize on that early, you know, wave of enthusiasm and that people have for a game, which, like you said, by the time you play it for hundreds of hours or whatever, even if you really, really enjoyed that, may well have kind of petered out a bit by then.
Yeah. But conversely, because these games have such a long DLC tail for the big payoff, like, I had enough time with both of those games that even after I put way too much time in them, you know, I had cooled down. And, like, I was like, okay, I can actually engage with this game again and be okay. Which helped out for me. I do want to talk a little bit about multiplayer DLC, though.
Also, we should point out as well that this, you know, I think the Splatoon 2 example with the Octo expansion is really kind of is not an isolated case if you think of that as a single player thing, because right. It kind of reminds me a bit. I mean, it's different, obviously, but it kind of reminds me a bit of New Super Luigi U. Because, you know, in terms of, you know, additional single player content, kind of shorter but more challenging kind of whole bunch of levels and all that. Obviously, Super Luigi U was strictly kind of repurposing the existing levels from the Super Mario Bros. U and all that, whereas Splatoon 2 Octo has got, like, I guess, more like new kind of settings and stuff than that did. But it's just in terms of the ethos of it, how much they charged, you know, this kind of focus on quick but tough kind of extra challenges for people who are into that. Yeah, that is a different model that they've got for a different kind of single player game, a shorter single player experience. You know, a linear, a new Super Mario Brothers is obviously not a sprawling 100-hour open world action adventure or an RPG or whatever else. So it's not like they don't have different models for different kinds of games.
Right. And I do think that the multiplayer games where they have offered DLC, it's always very a concern that you would end up splitting your market. And so for Mario Kart 8 on Wii U, they basically just said, that's fine. We'll split the market. Don't care. Because, of course, there were if you didn't have the tracks, you could not race on them. But for Splatoon 2, essentially it's just cosmetic. for the multiplayer component. For Smash, obviously, if you don't have the characters, you can still be beaten to death by them. You just can't play.
There's apparently many unfortunate victims of Bayonetta in the Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and 3DS can attest.
But you can still, you know, see them. You just can't play as them. So multiplayer DLC is really requires a whole different calculus of can I give this to some members of my audience but not all without dramatically harming the ecosystem of players and the player base. And that's a completely different conversation.
And yeah, so, like I said, it's Nintendo with the multiplayer sort of approach that it's adopted seems far more concerned with maintaining engagement with the game than people actually spending more money on it. That really does seem to be the principal
concern.
Yeah,
that's the ARMS model, essentially.
The ARMS and Splatoon 2 and Mario Tennis Aces, you know,
And Splatoon 1.
Yeah, they add more characters there. I mean, obviously, with the original Splatoon, you kind of had the feeling that, you know, some of that was very much kind of born out of necessity in terms of they just wanted to get the game out as quickly as they could because the Wii U was fading fast and, you know, there wasn't that much game there originally and then they were just adding to it. But however, how much of it was happenstance or you know, strategy, it seems to have developed into a model for them, which is, you know, I guess they feel it's important for people to keep playing these games, to keep talking about them, because that may well help, like, sales of the system, the sales of the games on the sort of more long tail basis as catalog titles.
Right.
I think they believe that it contributes to it. And of course, now we have to consider the Switch Online subscriptions that they're trying to sell to people. You know, and so if it's a case of like, oh, okay, you kind of subscribe for a month and play a game and you're kind of done with it online, that's not great because they want people to keep subscribing to the online plan.
Yeah. All right. We should probably step forward onto the next email. Greg, would you read the next one?
Sure. Seacore writes, Bouncy Bob is on sale for $0.01. On the Nintendo eShop and ranked number one bestseller for download only games and number three for all games in the eShop charts. This arguably poor quality game clearly
it's
wasn't.
It's not arguable. It's
it sounds like someone who wasn't, you know, it was too cheap to pony up the 1 cent to find out, but there we go. The arguably poor quality game would never show up in the bestsellers list without being put on sale for a single cent. Do you think that the great deals and bestsellers lists could be severely abused by unsavory developers and publishers of poor quality titles to game the system? Could we soon see the bestseller list riddled with shovelware? If it gets out of hand, what can Nintendo do about it? Do they need to do anything about it? Discuss.
I like the call to action at the end of the email. That's how you're supposed to end an imploring.
Yes.
So that game went down to a penny, which means I believe you got about as much in reward points as you actually spent on it.
Sure.
So it bounced to the top of the list because I think people saw, wait, that's a penny? What the fuck? And took a stab at it.
I'm surprised that Nintendo allows for that. I mean, this is, let us not forget, Nintendo who gave us, you know, the DSi shop where things, the pricing sort of intervals were entirely prescribed. You know, things right. Were either 200, you know, that you could be 200 DSi points, could be 500, could be 800, and that was about it. I think were 1200 as well, but you know, there were like four categories.
DSi, yes, your price categorization that you could of DSi have. Were points.
And then we were, for instance, like, the virtual console, for a long time, there were no sales at all. Like, ever, because the notion was, you know, the this sort of backward induction idea that if there's ever sales, then people will never buy full price because they're just waiting for the sale. So I
think what you're saying here, Greg, is that if the Bouncy Bob developer had been making a DSiWare game, they could not have gotten the attention on our game and their game by dropping the price. So they probably would have renamed their company something that starts with like a succession of the letter A.
To get to it, because that was the one lever that you had to pull on that.
It's Aardvark Games. Or
To sort of put yourself at the top of a list there. Look, obviously, they've moved on since those days. They've become more flexible with sales and promotions and all
and
that
pricing,
kind of stuff.
Like, you set your price and...
Yes, yeah, certainly, you know, they've been less nannying about all that kind of stuff. However, I'm still surprised they've got, you know, that liberal, that it's like, yeah, you want to cut it down to a cent? Go ahead. I am surprised at that. And you do wonder whether they might reconsider allowing that to happen if there were, as Secor suggests, a sort of raft of things that start to, a raft of games and publishers that start to use this tactic, kind of muddying up some of the charts and lists on the eShop, because, you know, for quite a while, discoverability has been, you know, talked about as an issue, something they need to work on. And then, of course, you know, like the actual, like, having a sales page and thing, like, these were things that were not there at the eShop at the beginning, so they've kind of added them to help, presumably, because, you know, people have wanted them. So I'm sure they don't want to see, you know, the charts and the deals list kind of just become completely overrun by the kinds of games that, you know, are not going to be high quality, high satisfaction type purchases. And, you know, then it makes everything else less discoverable.
I am not sure. I'm kind of confused by the business plan or the, I don't know, like, how much can actually dropping the game to 1 cent help with the discoverability and the sales of, and the profits of Bouncy Bob? I mean,
You wonder whether whether just trying it out to see what happens, you know.
Right. Well, how often does Nintendo refresh the top sellers page? You know, how often, how long would the game stay after the game?
Yeah, because that's really, presumably,
it seems to be fairly quick. Like, when that happens.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
That seems to be the point, presumably. The objective of this strategy is the sort of afterglow.
Nintendo's going to keep your one penny.
Yeah, you're still high in the charts. You're still visual. You know, you're clearly visible on those on the store as a result. While you're full price after the discount has elapsed, and that some people will, you know, kind of walk into this purchase not knowing that it was, you know, available for nothing just a few days earlier or something, and that will pay for it. Those at sort of almost accidental purchases will pay for the rest of it.
So I well, in the case of Bouncy Bob, it may just be that game didn't really cost that much to make, so whatever. But I went to go see if this nuclear Armageddon that we're being warned about has started. And Bouncy Bob is not...
I think it fights the domino theory.
Yeah, but Bouncy Bob is not the progenitor of this tactic. This was happening in the past. Bouncy Bob just took it to the absolute most extreme outcome of, no, 99% off. Like,
to the point where you kind of wonder if they understood the strategy.
Just showed that it was possible, you know what I mean? Because obviously, like, Nintendo's not necessarily going to talk about this in public that much, like, so I get to you, for us, it's like we might have thought maybe there's a flaw on how low the prices could go, either in proportional or absolute terms, but they've basically demonstrated that there isn't.
So there are free games on the eShop, but they're not deals because they're just free games, so they don't get to show up on this list. But
they have in-game purchases or whatever.
But remember, Bouncy Bob only costs $1 to begin with. So, like, it was already a basically nothing-priced game, But if you look at the sales and deals, now we're in the middle of their holiday sales, so there's a bunch of stuff on sale.
Yeah.
But what you will find is that there are a number of 90% off games that are hanging out in here. And some of them have crept into the top selling games list as a consequence of their sale. I don't know necessarily that it is an outcome that we need to particularly dread, because Frederick the musical adventure, or Frederick II Evil Strikes Back, which is about as an enjoyable concept as I can think of.
That is a phoned-in subtitle.
Yeah. Has been consistently going on sale like that. It has made no difference whatsoever. Smash is the number one selling game on Switch right now in the eShop. Bouncy Bob at one penny is number two. But Katamari Damacy Reroll is at three. Diablo, which went on sale today, is at four. Mario Odyssey, which is very much not on sale, is five. Overcooked to six.
Yeah, there'll be a roll in that for, you know, obviously people who are getting the system, you know, for the first time this,
right?
You know, this holiday cycle, and presume they might be redeeming codes from like retailers or something, or like bundles. So yeah, that because that's the thing. You know, if you have a situation like remember Bayonetta 2 had a Bayonetta code in it. Well, right. All the people that redeemed that code, it counted as a digital purchase. So that Bayonetta was high in the charts because of people buying physical copies of Bayonetta 2.
Beautiful. So Grease, which is new and on sale and getting rave reviews, is seventh. So not exactly a bad place for a game like that to land. Stardew Valley continues to be unstoppable.
Yeah, it's a perennial in the charts, that one.
Super Mario Party, which has somehow sold over 2 million units, in ninth. Mario Kart 8, which I assume is just people have run out of people to sell to, has fallen to 10th.
Did not do bad. So is there the stat that something like half of Switch owners own that and Zelda and Mario Odyssey? Like it's at a 50. Each of those games is at a 50% attachment,
like
which
that,
is
yeah.
You know, at this point now that the user base is, you know, sort of getting north of 20 million or whatever, that's well, it's probably way north of it by now, isn't it? Because they wanted to sell 20 million in this fiscal year, which would have made a total of 35. So that,
right.
I'm not sure whether they'll hit that or anything, but it must be way past 20 at this point worldwide.
My point is, you have to get all the way to number 11 to see one of these like bargain basement push my game to the front of the list things to hit, which is Car Quest, which is 90% off. And then to see the next one, it's Pikachu, Zelda, Skyrim, the Genesis Collection, which just came out, Celeste, not on sale, hanging out at 16, probably getting a bump from its exposure in the awards season, Eevee, Into the Breach, also not on sale, and then you get to the next one, Astro Bear's Party, which is perpetually 90% off, quote, on sale, down to 49 cents.
And then, yeah, I mean, look, this is a sort of, it's a slippery slope question that Secor, right. That's what made the domino right. theory gag, you know, it's...
What I'm getting at, though, is I don't think we need to worry.
Maybe not, but it is a projection. The idea is that, yes, it's not, you know, this will lead to something over time, not that it is that bad right now. And I guess the only... the only way you could answer that is kind of in what Guillaume sort of asked earlier on, is the question of like, well, you know, how does this all work out for their, you know, like for their bottom line, which we don't know. You know, it's like, yeah, great, you got it more, you got it greater visibility, but you also sold it for a cent right. for a lot of time. You know, the Nintendo's got that. And then you've kept nothing. And so how big are those afterglows? Is that actually a viable strategy in terms of on a revenue basis? Because if it's not, then, you know, it's not going to be very imitatable, is it?
No, and I think the novelty of the 1 cent game factored into Bouncy Bob being able to do something here. If this happened a bunch of times, people would just be like, "Oh, so one of these fucking."
Yeah, true. You people get inured to the it would not be as eyebrow raising,
right? And right. If you go look at the download only games, there's more of these popping up. So beyond Astro Bears and Car Quest, there's the Reload Heroes, and then No Thing. Like, there's a few more of these popping up. Lost in Harmony decided to be 85% off because they're not so dangerous. But, like, most of it is still games that are either well-regarded or games that are new or fucking Santa Tracker, which fuck you. Although, Don, Guillaume, you'll appreciate this. Don informed us that the Wii Motion Plus, not Wii Motion Plus, God damn it, the HD Rumble,
yes. Yeah,
plays Christmas carols.
Right. I refuse to download that thing to my... It's not even free, right?
It costs money.
Yeah.
It costs $2.
Yeah. I'm at the point where I refuse to download free or freeware on Switch free titles because it's... Yeah. I'm kind of... either it's from PETA. Yeah, or it's garbage. So anyway,
I mean, I think ultimately you get what you pay for, and there may be games that have some pop because they go like on a deep discount at some point. But I think ultimately this just isn't a viable way to get attention. It
right,
you could do it one time, like if somebody streaks through town naked, that's gonna get attention. If a whole bunch of people do it, eventually they just go like, oh, more of these right. assholes.
And there's a whole bunch of games that are like 90% off, like that. I've noticed that. Kind yeah. of starting like last month or maybe a little bit over that.
It's been going for about a year now. Like it's just gotten out of hand because there's more games that can go to 90% off because there's more games, period.
Right. I just linked in the chat a tweet from SMG Studio, an Australian developer who made Death Squared. And so like their game has been on the eShop for 400 days and they've actually posted the chart of the sales and how it's been selling. And so they kind of we see the spikes and like they've labeled them like how much the rebate was. And so yeah, like you can see that the sales softening over time. It's kind of funny because they did an experiment at some point, like they just had it like 10% off and there's almost no bump. And so, you know, in the tweet they're just like 10% off experiment, don't do that. Because it's not worth it. But yeah, like they seem to say that the sweet spot for sales in relation to revenue is 20 to 25% off is like where they get the most bang for their buck.
Yeah, it affects behavior, but it doesn't actually slash your revenue by too much to kind right. of make it right. not worth you, worth your while.
You as a consumer see that number and see the difference in price and go, oh, that's significant.
Yeah.
But if you have a $1 game and you go 25% off, I don't say that's significant. I say, wow, that game is probably not good.
Yeah, but right. obviously there's a relative component to this and there's an absolute component to this. And that's the sweet spot will vary according to the initial price of said game. I do think, though, that if the slippery slope were to come into play, if the domino started falling, Nintendo would not be above getting the old clunking fist involved to put a stop yeah. to it.
they got a lot of credit for the laissez-faire approach they've taken to pricing and stuff. But I think if it got bad, what would happen is the partners they want to work with would probably complain and they'd be like, all right.
Yeah. They would not be shy about intervening if they felt or were convinced that it was necessary or productive to do so.
But and the intervention could be relatively slight. It may not be a change in policy. It may be just a change in how the deals page works. It may be a change in how the best sellers list works. You know, it could be. It may be that they get rid of those pages altogether and replace them with the curated list, like.
Which all they also have, you know, they have a feature thing, but yeah, expanding that, because yeah, at the end of the day, it seems that discoverability is the primary concern right. here.
There's a way for them to do this that doesn't require them to change their policies in a way that looks heavy-handed, but achieves the objective they're looking for. Anyway, so Klex Yoshi writes, Dear RFN crew, favorite new arrangement in Smash Brothers Ultimate, go. Geek, listen to the soundtrack on YouTube or the website or something, you Canadian cretin. It gives you a little heart. And you better edit
affectionate use of the word cretin, apparently. Yeah.
And you better edit each snippet of the track as it's discussed. Yeah, extra work, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's happening on this schedule. The podcast.
You can Google it. It's out there.
This podcast is scheduled to come out the day before Christmas Eve. Don't think so.
For the record, I'm bouncing between the field, Firefield / Porttown mashup that Takenobu Mitsuyoshi did and that Boppin' Lost Painting arrangement by Tetsuya Shibata. Sorry, I had to move my microphone because it is uniquely placed in a way that I could not read that email.
Because I won't have time to edit the tracks and let's read the URL for each of these.
Yeah, so...
Type it as we say it.
I will say...
XG_
Clex Yoshi's favorites there have been duly noted for future ending music possibilities, certainly.
Oh, good.
We may hear them eventually, but yeah, not in the sort of interstitial kind of capacity that he was envisioning. Interesting choices there. So the Firefield Porttown matchup, is that the vocal one?
It must be, I would think.
From the Daytona guy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like it's going to say F-Zero, robots in disguise.
As we discussed, the F-Zero characters are nightmares, and if they were just robots manufactured, it would feel better.
Yeah, so yeah, that's fun. And something different, because I think there is a legitimate point to make here that after so many Smash Brothers games, especially when the soundtrack's really sort of ballooning with Brawl and then 3DS, Wii U, and now Ultimate, they are treading some of the same ground quite a bit, to be fair. Yeah. I mean, it's, I guess some of it's driven by stages, you know, so it's like, well, this song or this like motif from a series fits a particular stage, so they kind of come along and like do another remix of that to have a new version of it. But you know, I mean, look, there's, I think one of the first things I did with the Smash Ultimate soundtrack, so I think there was a challenge thing for making a playlist, so one of the first things I did was go in and pick out all the new arrangements that are marked with the little pink kind of corner on the and just put them all in a playlist. And I think you end up with like about 100 odd. So it's a lot of stuff. That alone is a lot of stuff. And I mean, in terms of the total number of songs, you know, when it's all said and done, you're talking about 900 odd, you know.
Right.
And that includes songs that are not new remixes, but they are new songs because they're original for this game, you know, World of Light, that kind of stuff. So there's tons of new music in this thing, as well as a very robust selection of pre-existing music from previous Smash Brothers games and just the constituent games, constituent series that go into it. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, even having poured a very large amount of time into Smash Ultimate over, you know, a couple of weeks, I still haven't heard the new ones like that much, you know, to like rank them, because you see so much stuff in Smash. I've always played it with the sound on very loudly or anything, so it's kind of I think my favorites will change over time, probably with playing the game further, because that's generally what happens with music. If you know, albums, anything, you know, certain songs grow on you over time, whereas others kind of have more of an immediate impact and then maybe kind of fade down the list. But the one I'm liking at the moment has got to be Crocodile Cacophony. This is the final boss theme from DKC2. Remixed by someone relatively new to the Nintendo sound department, Soshi Abe, I think his name is, and so his first credits for Nintendo are actually on the Zelda DLC. So he's really, you know, new to the company. But this is a fantastic reworking of that. There's always been a great last boss theme, but this kind of goes in, embellishes it with the instrumentation, and kind of the one drawback of it was kind of a short loop, you know, they didn't really go anywhere. And it kind of addresses that by incorporating some other aspects of the DKC2 soundtrack into it, which was always a classic soundtrack, as the first one was too. And it's just really high energy. I think it's a little more up tempo than it was originally, and just kind of fully realized version of that song. So that's really great. And obviously, it's there for the DK stages, but you will also specifically find it on the Spirit fight with Captain, with a K rule.
Yes,
which is pretty deep into it, I think.
Is that the K rule theme from the trailer?
I'm trying to remember, because was it that, or there's also a new remix of Gangplank Galleon.
It's got to be Gangplank Galleon,
which is the final boss from the first DKC. Yeah, and they had already remixed. And this is what I'm talking about. Like, they'd already remixed that once, and they remixed it again.
Yeah, and that's a really good remix now.
Yeah, and we talked about this when I used the version of Chill from Dr. Mario. It's like, yeah, this is the second remix they've done of Chill, and this time Ip Tanaka did it himself. And, you know, I mean, that's where we are now with Smash. But so, I mean, some of the stuff, you know, is kind of cool, but not the most interesting, because it is just another version of something that's been done before. But this was, I mean, they've done DKC2 stuff before. They did Sticker Brush Symphony, like back on Brawl and stuff. You know, it's always been, like I said, a great soundtrack, great to draw from, but it's a great choice, this one. I didn't play DKC2 until Wii Virtual Console, but it stuck out to me then as like, oh yeah, this is, you know, especially because Gangplank Galleon was kind of a classic last boss theme. The fact that they managed to follow it up in the second one with something quite different, you know, quite a bit more intense, less whimsical, but still catchy and fun. And now you've got this great version of it to go along with the versions of Gangplank Galleon, and with K. Rool being a character and stuff, is top notch.
So part of me wants to lean into some of the third party stuff that's come in. Yuzo Koshiro did a remix of Guile's theme. But Guile's theme has been remixed 100 million times. And as much as I would have loved to have heard Guile's theme as rendered by the Sega Genesis sound chip, because Yuzo Koshiro is stuck in 1992 and really likes that sound for some reason, because of course he basically lived there. It's fine. It's a fine remix, whatever. But the Vega stage...
that's a good one.
Done by Yoko Shimomura. Basically,
write that originally? Isn't that like Ip Tanaka doing Chill? Like, didn't she do Street Fighter 2 soundtrack?
Yes, that is her soundtrack. She's listed as a supervisor for this remix, and she does herself. Like this is maximum Shimomura music. But weirdly, that's not the one I want to go with. Like, it's an outstanding remix.
I like that one. Yeah,
it's really good. It's better than any time that Vega's actually had a theme, kind of capturing the sort of what they're going for with him. And so there's that weird sense in the Castlevania stuff. It's all really good, but all of that music's been remixed a million times. And
it's mixed in with remixes from other games, as we said, like Judgment has done it, and the Castlevania the Arcade. All this, it's true. I mean, it's well traveled. So classic stuff, pretty well traveled. That's why I think Klex's point about the Lost Painting version is cool, because that's less obvious. We talked about that when they showed us the list in that Smash Direct of Castlevania songs, or at least part of the list, that were going to be in it. And it was like, Lost Painting is quite a sort of chilled out, you know, song. Like, what are they going to do with that? But, you know, they did something cool with it. So it's nice when it is a bit more off the beaten track.
And I say that, but the Bloody Tears remix, which is just like screaming guitars, I kind of appreciate. I don't like the Monster Dance part of it so much, so that one doesn't get in there. For me, it's probably a Mega Man remix. Specifically, it's the We're Robots, which is Dr. Wily Stage 2, which I don't know that I've heard that stage remixed that much. Obviously, it's happened before, because every Mega Man song has been remixed at some point. But that's a very kind of unique take on that song. That is composed by Yu Shimoda, who I don't know much about at all. but it, I kind of dig it. Like, I like what that, how that does, because in Ultimate, if you haven't played it, which you probably have, because they sold tremendous number of copies of this game, you actually start hearing the song in the Spirit Battle, especially. You start hearing the song that's going to play before you actually get into the fight. Like, on the character select screen, when you're setting up, the music's already playing. And so, in the case of that one, by the time you get to the fight, generally speaking, it's right around the time the music's rounding into form to get to the big action. And it just has a nice feel to it. Like, it's a really solid remix of that song that I didn't know I needed a remix of.
And it comes in handy with the spirit mode, because there's so many encounters, but yet that so often they're able to pull a piece of music that is actually pretty appropriate for it.
Right, and you spend a lot of time doing setup, dealing with those encounters, because there's a lot of stuff that needs to get done. The one thing I'm a little bit disappointed about, though, is, and people are going to laugh, but whatever, I know Game & Watch games didn't really have music as such, or not much, and it was just beeping. We still only have Flat Zone and Flat Zone 2, which have been around for goddamn ever.
There's quite a few series or sectors of the soundtrack that basically didn't get anything.
Right.
For this. You know, like that, or maybe one new remix that's a remix of something that had already been given the remix treatment before.
So Mario Kart didn't get any new remixes.
Star Fox, I think. Star Fox gets some new music, like, for in terms of tracks that hadn't been in before, like from
but no
Zero.
New remixes.
But not actually new remixes.
Yoshi gets one. From Yoshi's New Island. You know, that game with the soundtrack that everyone loves.
To be fair, it is nice to hear that theme with instrumentation that's
instead of offensive
than it was before.
Yeah, well, that song is notoriously awful. And they went and they made it considerably less awful. Actually, I didn't mention it, but Cass's theme remix, I've never actually heard it in-game. The only time I heard it was listening to it to prepare for the song. I'm like, oh, that's nice. But the thing about the remix is what makes a remix good versus, oh, that's nice, versus, oh, that's bad. A remix just means you've changed anything, effectively. And a lot of these remixes, like, they are of more modern games, like, they are remixes, but they don't really, like, move the needle on the game. They're not transformative work.
No, I mean, because, again, you've gone to a different place. Like, when you think of Melee... at that time, it was kind of the sense of bringing, you know, like 8 and 16-bit themes and having them performed by an orchestra.
Right.
And really kind of bringing them to life in a way that you hadn't necessarily heard before. Whereas, yeah, I mean, it's very different now, because you kind
all
of
the
draw...
Xenoblade music is orchestral.
Yeah, exactly. The actual, like, core game. I mean, like, a great example of that is that going back to, I think, Smash for Wii U and 3DS, although it carries over to this one. You know, like, the remix of the Super Mario Galaxy sort of theme of, you know, the first world, or the Egg Galaxy, or whatever it was called. Right. Like, it sounds worse in Smash Brothers than it did in Galaxy, because it's not live instruments. Which is the exact opposite of what we had in Melee. You know, that's where we've got to. So, like, the constituent games have superseded Smash Brothers in terms of just pure, like, you know, fidelity and like all that kind of stuff. So it's a different kind of dynamic now than it was before. I think now it's more about, you know, can you do like something interesting with a pre-existing theme. But funnily enough, my choice, you know, the Crocodile Cacophony is kind of an exception to that, because you're talking about a 16-bit song that hadn't really been remixed very much and bringing it up to, you know, a level of fidelity with the instruments that really kind of makes it more intense. So that's like a little sort of pocket of Melee sort of philosophy still operating.
Well, so funny you say that, because We're Robots, the one that ultimately was my pick, is from Mega Man 9, which means it was a game made to sound like a retro song written well after that is something that should have happened, a chiptune song, that they then went and up-rezzed to actual instrumentation and made jazzier.
And it's still 10 years old, so it's, you know, 10 it's, years it's old, plenty like, retro enough to be Smash Bros.
It's just like there's like weird, like this weird cyclical nature of we're going to make this retro sounding song when these are out of being in vogue. And then Smash Brothers coming along 10 years later, we're going to take this retro sounding song and make it sound modern. You're like, listen, asshole, it could have sounded like this the first time. They just chose not to. There's a Mega Man. I think that's the only thing from there's two Mega Man 9 songs, but the other one is just straight up, this is the music from the game.
Yeah, there's plenty of those tracks. And I mean, you know, there's plenty of good stuff that gets in the soundtrack. I'm glad they do that, you know, to kind of beef up how many songs there are in the game. And there's, like I said, I mean, especially with some of the more modern stuff, it's kind of like, well, what would you do? What would you do? Like, with the Mario Galaxy example kind of proves it. Like, I don't, apart from, like, radically reworking it into something quite different, there's not really that much, you know, maybe making an interesting medley of things from, you know, it kind of did that with Xenoblade, where they, you know, strung a bunch of the themes together into a short, you know, relatively short song. But, you know, they're already at such a high level of quality that it's difficult to just kind of play the, like, bring it to life card. And, you know, that's that, because they're just that good already. You know, Nintendo have been taking it pretty seriously, you know, now the soundtrack stuff and the instrumentation stuff, you know, since those days, since the kind of the Wii era.
Yeah, and to kind of close out on that thought, I just, as you had said that, I said, okay, what's Splatoon got? Because of course that game's music is a big part of what it is, and so what they did is they gave remixes to Hip Tanaka and Yuzo Koshiro and said, okay, go nuts, and they didn't really go that nuts. They even who have very distinct styles kept it fairly in check for what those games are. But I think that's probably the way you do it. You give it to somebody who has a voice in their music that's significantly different from what the game is, what those games are, and say, okay, reinterpret in your style. And that lets you do some stuff you couldn't do otherwise, because it forces a new sound into the same song. All right, well, that is going to do it for us for this week. I said it was going to be short. I kind of delivered. Yeah, I did. No, I delivered. I did it. It's also going to do it for 2018 for Radio Free Nintendo. As I said at the start of the show, Greg, what is the email address for the show?
rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
We also found out what RFN stands for today. That's exciting.
yes. Radio Free Ninjago, yeah.
Yeah, Radio Free Ninjago. The Ninjagis. I'm the president of Ninjogo. I heard you've been talking shit. That's still my favorite email. I will retire from this show with that being my favorite email, because it doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Leader in the clubhouse is sort of understating it, is that what
it doesn't make any sense at all. It's ridiculous. It's like, we didn't even talk shit about Ninjago. I just said it's like it's a kid show. I don't know. It's weird. Oh, heard you've been talking shit. We had. You're right. You're right, Mr. President. I apologize.
It's difficult to dispute that assertion. Yeah.
You know, I mean, we do a lot of that, so I could say prove me wrong, but you could, so I'm going to let you have it. But that is going to do it for the show and for the year, because we'll be taking next week off. But as I said, it doesn't matter. It would have been in 2019 anyway. So first episode you'll hear from us is probably around the 8th or 9th of January, back when we're all back at work, working like schmucks. Ugh, for the man. Yeah. But it's okay. John will be back, probably, if the aliens have given him back, which they will have by then. They'll have been sick of it. So, as always, thank you for listening. And with that, Guillaume, I'm going to ask you, what's our music this week? I hope you're prepared.
I am.
Damn it!
It's not like we missed the at some point just now, and it got edited. Anyway, yeah, so I chose
I like the idea if you just leave it in there. It sounds like I'm an asshole who was trying to trick you.
So, I chose the ending music this week. I like Christmas music. Well, that's not even remotely true.
I'm about to say, no, you don't. Christmas.
I like Christmas. I like music that evokes, you know, winter and Christmassy feelings. I don't necessarily enjoy
Santa got run over by a reindeer for three months straight. Yeah, it's great.
It's a couple of years ago now. I was standing in line at the pharmacy, and there was, the sort of boilerplate Christmas jingles playing over the PA. And the fellow in front of me just out loud, apropos of nothing, said, "Makes me want to die." And, you know, I'd love to say I disagreed with it, but I sure as shit didn't.
Anytime I can get the opportunity to hear the fucking Christmas shoot song again, I just leap up to the world and say, yes, please, I want to be depressed.
I don't think I've heard that. I've just seen that referenced in a thread that was saying, like, isn't Wonderful Christmas Time, the Paul McCartney song, like, the worst ever? And people were like, counterpoint, Christmas shoes.
Yeah, his mother.
So I need to listen to that.
His mother is dying, and he's trying to find a shoe store that's open so she can have nice shoes when she meets Jesus. That's the Christmas song. Merry Christmas, everybody!
What the hell?
Okay. Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, I'll take the crappy synthesizer music of Paul McCartney.
I thought you're going to like a Philip Glass Christmas.
Oh boy!
Yeah, it's Christmas brought to you by the Candyman School.
All this to say that I was listening to, I heard the music from Stardew Valley when Karen was playing during wintertime, and there's at least a couple of, tracks that play during winter, and I hadn't heard that one, and it was, I don't know, it's like this really calming, really nice little music. So it's Nocturne of Ice. And it's from the Stardew Valley soundtrack. And, enjoy.
And by rights, that would have been the title of a Castlevania game had they kept making them at the clip that they were doing during the 2000s.
It would have happened eventually.
Absolutely.
Just as a matter of statistics.
Preferably on a console that had the initials NI, I suppose.
Oh yeah, so the Nintendo Intermediate would have been awesome.
The Nintendo Initiative.
That sounds dire.
It's like that's a code name, but it might have held over. You know, sometimes code names do.
That sounds like a CIA code name though. They're gonna rub somebody out.
The Initiative. Yeah, it
does. It's the Nintendo Initiative. What's that mean? We're gonna beat that Italian in the head.
I think that was a nefarious organization in a Buffy story arc once. So yeah, that's how generic that is.
Oh, nice.
Well, that's a hell of a way to end the year. But on that, bye everybody.
Riley was a better character than people give him credit for.
Remembered. Well remembered. Bye-bye, everybody.
God damn it. Thank you.